Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Mysterious Japan. This is Episode 2, Expunging Evil from the Suicide Forest. As explored in Episode 1, Jukai grew over the bodies of the 30,000 men, women, and children buried under the lava and ash when Mount Fuji erupted. For 500 years, their bodies remained encased in the lava substrate, even when it was nothing but a forest in its infancy. Jukai developed a reputation of harboring evil in the northwest shadow of Mount Fuji. Part 1. Becoming a Living Buddha. The prevailing belief was that Jukai had a deep-rooted cultural memory of evil, tragedy, and death stored within its rocks and land formations. Whatever evil existed there before the Great Eruption was now held there by the sea of lava with its piezoelectric energy. This is augmented, so the ancient people believed, by the cries from the dead buried there. Thus it is that in 1340 Common Era, a Buddhist monk named Shokai determined to make a sacrifice to provide karmic release of the negative energies stored there. He knew of one way to do this, a method pioneered by a monk named Kukai in the 9th century. The process would take over 6 years and result in his own slow and painful death. But Shokai was determined to do this for the sake of the people living in the region. He would mummify himself and be entombed while still alive as a self-sacrifice, and thus he traveled to Jukai to begin this sacrifice. Shokai was a Buddhist monk belonging to the Shingon sect. The Shingon Buddhist monks believed in extreme asceticism. They denied themselves of all pleasures, abstaining from their desires and appetites to obtain spiritual goals. For Shingon Buddhists like Shokai, proper self-mummification would elevate a monk into a living Buddha called a Sokushinbutsu. To them, this is the greatest good a person can do. And just what did it take to become a living Buddha? It is an extreme process of self-denial called Nujo. If accomplished, it would free people from their sins and liberate a land from bad karma. Through Nujo, Shokai monk believed he would not die, but instead would enter a state of meditation so profound that he crossed a threshold into suspended animation, emerging in the distant future to usher souls to nirvana. And just what did Nujo require? Shokai began the first stage. This involves a 1,000-day specialized diet called Mokujikijyo, or tree eating. Shokai subsisted on roots, nuts, berries, tree bark, and pine needles. To quell hunger, he occasionally ingested small river rocks. He engaged in a constant state of fasting, meditating, and praying during this 3-year process. The diet and lack of movement prepared his body for mummification, eliminating all fat and most muscle from his body. It also deprived his body's internal bacteria of nutrients and moisture that normally would result in decomposition. The second stage lasted another 1,000 days. This 3-year period was the self-embalming process. Shokai gradually lowered his intake of bark and roots, and he added a specially brewed tea to his diet at the end of the 1,000 days. He made the tea from the Yuroshi tree, a poisonous sap used to make Japanese lacquer. This tea lowered his body fluid levels and prevented insects and pests from consuming his flesh after death. It created a toxicity that would kill such invaders and preserve his body. It also had the effect of fastening his remaining muscles to the bone. He began tapering off his diet, including his consumption of water, and began entering a state of complete fasting. During this second stage, he meditated constantly, sitting without moving like a statue. He moved only to take small amounts of his urushi tea or water. When awake, he constantly chanted a sutra in a low voice. The third stage is the most shocking to modern sensibilities. The ritual calls for the monk to fit into a small space where no movement is possible and wait without moving until death. In other words, the monk would be buried alive. The monks typically received assistance interring themselves in cramped pine boxes. These would then be buried 10 feet below the ground. The monk would have only a long bamboo straw leading to the surface to provide some means of receiving air. Sometimes they had a bell to ring. The bell was not for emergencies, quite the opposite. It was to let the assisting monks above ground know when the monk was dead. Once the bell stopped ringing, and once they could no longer hear the recitation of sutras from the bamboo straw, the monks could safely assume that the monk was dead, yet they still would not dig up the monk. Instead, they would wait another 1,000 days. Then they would disinter and inspect the monk's corpse. If they found signs of decay, they would respectfully inter the body in a tomb, but consider the mummification process to have been a failure. But if they found no decay, they proclaimed the monk to be a successful living Buddha. Shokai did not have the luxury of being buried alive in a pine box. Not at Jukai. The lava rock, just a few inches below the surface of Jukai's soil, prevented burial. Instead, he found one of the hundreds of tiny lava caves in Jukai. A tight squeeze deep in the darkness where no light could reach, he wedged himself in the rocks, meditated without food or water, recited his sutra, and waited for death. Local Buddhists did not remove his body after confirming his living Buddha status, nor did they disclose where Shokai interred himself. To this day, no one knows for sure where his mummified body is or which cave out of the hundreds of caves in Jukai entombs his remains. Shokai's sacrifice ushered in a pilgrimage of other monks looking to purify and sacrifice themselves through ritual fasting. Their bodies may still be entombed in the caves of Jukai. Part 2. Self-mummification to purge Jukai of evil. Another monk following this pilgrimage at Jukai was named Miroku. In 1733, he followed the Nujo practice of self-mummification. Many think his sacrifice opened the final connection, creating a spiritual doorway between Mount Fuji and Jukai. A century later, in 1827, one more monk followed this example. His name has been lost to history, but he claimed that a cave in Jukai called out to him, bringing him to the forest. When he reached Shoji Village, near Shoji Lake, he searched out the cave that had called to him. He finally found it. The villagers later named this cave the Cave of Devotion. They used it as a place of worship. This monk followed an oath called Seigyo, which taught him that Mount Fuji, Lake Shoji, and the Shoji Cave united into a divine trinity. Holding always to this belief, he lived among the local villagers for several years. After a villager died in a fishing accident, the son approached the monk and asked, "If the three really are a divine trinity of this land, then can't they bring back my father?" The monk pondered how this aligned with his Seigyo oath. Troubled by the inequities, he told the villagers, "I will give up my life to save this people and this land from evil and sin. I will become a living Buddha like Shakai and Miroku." He began the self-mummification process. After completing the first two stages, he entered the Cave of Devotion. He told the villagers that his sacrifice would allow him to take upon himself their suffering. Then he descended into the cave to begin his meditation, refusing all food and drink. No light from the sun reached him. He squeezed into a spot so small he could hardly move, and there he sat unmoving in meditation for 50 days. The villagers venerated the cave and raised a shrine and stone monument in worship. They buried their dead near the cave, heaping dirt into piles over them since they could not dig. They wanted to remain close to this living Buddha after death. No one knew where this monk interred himself. That is, until a journalist in 2010 believed he found the spot. Part 3. The Reporter and the Secret Religion. For over 20 years, journalist Ramu Maruta wrote articles about Jukai for various publications. He counted over 100 visits to the forest. In 2010, he pulled an assignment to investigate and write an article on Jukai. With him traveled a young editor. She was a first-timer at Jukai. Their goal was to investigate rumors of a secret religion being practiced within the forest. Ramu knew of these rumors. He chalked them up to urban legends, just like the rumor that there was a secret village of failed suicide victims somewhere in the forest. This mystical religion legend was well known. But in the back of his mind, after 100 visits, he began to think there might be some truth to this rumor. If so, he suspected that the facilities were somewhere near Lake Shoji. This is the spot where the unidentified monk had mummified himself to save the villagers in the early 19th century. They spent the entire morning asking locals about the religion and where they could find its facilities. They talked to restaurant owners, innkeepers, and even some local homeowners. Ramu was about to concede that it was just a legend, but then one restaurant owner gave him a lead. She said a trail led to a building deep in the forest. The trail started behind a fire station and led up a hill into the trees. Though imperceptible from the main road, the restaurant owner assured them the gravel road was there. When Ramu asked if it led to the religious facility, the answer he received was vague. "It looks like it, I think." With the editor in tow, he found the fire station and the trail behind it. Elated, they started hiking up an incline that led between the trees. The road soon narrowed to a gravel one-way path, still wide enough for a car, but with steep slopes on each side. After another half-hour hike, the road bifurcated into a mountain trail, unpaved and marked with a suicide prevention sign, asking hikers to please reconsider if they are coming to the forest to commit suicide. These signs were scattered throughout the main trails. What this meant to Ramu was that they had officially entered Jukai. Thinking that perhaps the religious facility was up the mountain path, the editor convinced Ramu to take a detour up through the trees. After a few minutes of climbing the hill, she jumped up and down.
"I think I found it!"
She pointed across the way. Through the trees, Ramu could make out something artificial, but he was suspicious. What he saw was too far away to make out details. Trees obscured his vision. He took out his telephoto lens and zoomed in. Through the lens, it looked like a lump wrapped in a blue tarp. With a shake of his head, Ramu said, "I think it's just garbage." He looked again down the lens. The lump of garbage moved, not from the wind, but from a person. Someone was down there. He watched for a few more moments. Two people emerged. Given the propensity for suicide in the forest, he felt an ethical duty to investigate, but he was hesitant without knowing what kind of people they were. It might be dangerous. He felt that he could neither leave nor approach. The editor said she would call the police, but she was unable to get a signal on her cell phone.
"I'll be right back."
She then disappeared down the trail to find a signal, leaving Ramu alone with two strangers about 50 yards away. He stayed out of sight, watching the figures through his telephoto lens and staying behind the trees as cover. An hour passed. When the editor finally returned, she said,
"The police say there have been many reports of corpses found today, but finding people alive like this is rare, so they're coming right away. They want us to stay, just in case."
They waited nearly another hour. Then the editor excused herself again to see if perhaps the police were not able to find the trail. And yet another hour passed while he waited alone among the trees just off the trail. The lump of blue tarp hardly moved. The two figures there were not active, but the occasional movement told Ramu they were alive. The tarp had been shaped into a makeshift tent. When two figures emerged again, all he could see was that they were wearing white raincoats. Finally, the editor returned with two police officers. Together, they approached the figures, and Ramu was surprised to find that they were old women. Upon seeing the police, one of them started to sob. "We have nowhere to go. We have no choice but to die." The police officers soothed them down and determined that they were two sisters who came to Jukai to die together. When asked why they want to die, the old lady responded, "It's the internet. There's so much bad stuff written on there about us, all that slander. There's nothing to do but die." The police officer asked with forced patience,
"Aunties, do you know what the internet is? There are people who say the television says bad things about them, but they don't have to resort to this."
The old ladies appeared confused and mentally debilitated. Ramu believed they were hallucinating and not in their right minds. As the police dismantled the tents, they removed a mortuary tablet. The women explained that they took it from the graveyard. It belonged to their mother. They said they had been worshiping the tablet for 3 days without hardly drinking or eating anything. They hoped they would just become too weak and die. The officers took them away in their patrol car after thanking Ramu and the editor for calling them in. Ramu knew that if they had not done anything, the old ladies would have died within days. They were not in their right minds. It would have been a slow and painful death by starvation and dehydration. Then he thought again about the Sakushinbutsu monks starving themselves into living mummies. But this was something far different. A cool breeze reminded him that they were there to find the facilities of this strange religion. They had found the old ladies just after noon, and about 3 hours had passed since then. Everyone knows that darkness falls early in Jukai. The air was cooling already. They hiked back to the gravel road and walked further up the hill, following what they thought were the instructions given by the restaurant owner. After a half hour of hiking, he thought this was a wild goose chase. Discouraged, he said to the young editor,
"I wonder if there is such a religion out there."
The editor responded with youthful enthusiasm,
"There is. If you believe, it will surely be there."
Ramu shook his head, laughing softly. Soon, the road bifurcated once more. One of the roads was blocked by a barricade like those seen at construction sites. A wooden board was affixed to the barricade. On one side of the wooden sign, attached to the barricade, were the expected words "Safety First," but on the other side, the side facing the road, someone had written the words "Kentoku Dojo." The editor was jubilant.
"That's it! It's just past there."
And Reimu thought she might be right. Dojo is a place of training. They hiked past the barricade, and after about 10 minutes, they came upon a small prefab building. As they approached, Reimu noticed tombs and graves all around the building and adjacent to it. A fresh offering lay at the cave entrance. The graves were so old that their inscriptions were unreadable. Many had collapsed. Others were overgrown with grass. He knew immediately that these graves existed long before erection of the prefab building. The hackles on his neck rose, but he continued forward confidently, unwilling to show fear in front of the editor. He realized they may have just found what they were looking for. They approached the building and saw a piece of paper taped with scotch tape to the wall next to the door. Written were words of prayer. "We really did find the rumored religious facility," Reimu thought. He was as shocked as he was excited. They waited there for a minute, almost afraid to knock, but finally Reimu rapped his knuckles on the door. When it slid open, an old woman stood before them.
"May I help you?"
Surprised by the woman's appearance, Reimu stuttered, not sure what to say after this long day's search.
"Well, we heard rumors about this place, I think."
"Are you students here to learn? This is a place of religious learning, or are you just a regular person?"
"I am just a regular person. We are not students."
"Okay, but there is an important project going on right now. It is dangerous for it to be leaked to the outside world."
Reimu and the editor nodded their understanding at this strange comment. The old lady invited them inside to wait until the master returned, and they drank some tea in silence. After a few minutes, an old man entered the front door. He was dressed as a monk. The woman introduced Reimu and the editor. The old man's face lit up.
"Sorry to have kept you waiting. I was in another prefecture until yesterday. It's fate to meet in this way. It's fate."
The old man was talking rapidly, excitedly. Reimu opened his mouth to talk about why they were there. He had no chance to speak. The old man jumped in with quick staccato words.
"This is a dojo, a path of learning. Do you understand the meaning of the Chinese character for path?"
Taken aback by this odd question, Reimu shakes his head. The old man does not wait for a response. He tells Reimu an intricate explanation of the Chinese characters. Something about a car and putting rice on a car, about getting lost and seeking the path of the dojo so you do not lose your neck. While Reimu tries to process this incomprehensible explanation of the Chinese characters, the old man goes wild with excitement. Reimu realizes this is perhaps a troubled man. It is getting late, so he quickly interrupts to ask him why he started a new religion here. For once, the old man quieted and slowed his speech.
"I wanted to die in the Pacific War, to kill myself in battle. But as soon as I joined the army, the war ended. I had no purpose and ended up in this forest, intent on committing suicide. I wandered for 10 years before arriving at this place, planning to commit suicide, but never following through. The people in town fed me and even built me a hut. They said they would be troubled and saddened if I died. They practiced true Buddhism. They cared. They really cared."
This statement rings true for Reimu. Many soldiers disappeared into Jukai after the war, feeling useless and betrayed by their country. They did not die with honor in the battlefield, so many chose instead to die among the trees at Jukai. Then the old man continues, nodding toward the graves and cave outside.
"Believers came here at one point, long before I was born, and I wondered why. It would have been a long climb, maybe an hour on foot from their nearest village. Why go to all that trouble? Japan is a special country. The people of Japan are special people. Japan is the god of the universe, who controls hundreds of billions of stars. I ask God, God, why did you create the world? And you know what God told me? He didn't create the world. I was surprised."
The man continued talking like this, his speech devolving into bizarre ranting. Reimu found himself noticing that it was now dark. The small prefab building only had a generator for electricity and propane tanks for gas. The couple apparently did not turn on their lights at night. Shadows covered the man's angular face. Ramu wanted to know about the cave and the religion that was started in the forest of Jukai. He interrupts to ask about this. The man pauses to think before continuing.
This is a dojo that knows when the kingdom of God will come. There is no humanity in the kingdom of God. No humanity. We are working to end humanity. Today was destined. It was destiny for us to meet. The time is coming soon. Be prepared.
But isn't this a cult?
The young editor had hardly spoken a word since they arrived. Her words seemed to anger the old man, though he does not respond. Instead, his wife brings them all plates carrying rice, boiled potatoes, and a pickled vegetable. Ramu thanks them and eats. He didn't realize how hungry he was. But the food is cold, and he knows it is time to leave. He politely asks forgiveness, but it is time for them to return. Before leaving, he asks about the cave. The old man takes them to the front door and points across to the nearby cave.
A long time ago, an old monk went down there and became a living Buddha.
Ramu couldn't get this thought out of his mind. Does this mean there is a monk's corpse deep down in that hole somewhere? Could this be the nameless monk who sacrificed himself in Jukai almost 200 years ago? The young editor was satisfied that they found what they came looking for. This was the rumored religion. Although the rumor proved to be true, the details were not as scintillating as she had hoped. The leader of the religion was not right in the head, but he had been a kind old man. Ramu agreed. But perhaps this man was not the leader of the religion itself. The monuments by the cave indicated that worship occurred here in the distant past. For a long time, Ramu thought about this strange encounter. In later years, he returned twice by himself, but it appeared the old man and woman had abandoned the prefab house. They were old and perhaps had to leave for health reasons. Or perhaps their imminent project, whatever it was, had finally begun. On his last return visit, Ramu decided he must know what was down that cave. Part 4. Searching for the mummy. Ramu descends, flashlight shining down the hole. The cave is a typical lava tube commonplace throughout Jukai. Some extend for miles and branch off into tributaries. Most have never been explored. Some are large and some are narrow. This one is wide enough for one person to descend while hunched over. Very narrow and constricting. A bit too small, he thinks to himself. The tunnel is soon pitch black. The only light comes from his flashlight. He cannot imagine coming down here 2 centuries ago without a light source for the sole purpose of starving himself to death. The hardened lava walls are jagged. Every time he rubs against them, he feels like he is rubbing against a cheese grater. He has to frequently kneel. This hurts his knees on the rough ground. He hits his head on the low ceiling time and again. Both his knees and head are throbbing. After descending for a few minutes, he sees vines and something that looks like purple nuts in front of him. As he approaches, he realizes they are not nuts at all. They are bats, hibernating bats. He carefully sidesteps the bats in the tight squeeze and continues his descent. The surface of the walls in the cave drip with moisture. Water glistens over craggy rocks and outcroppings. This constant moisture creates a slippery, slimy surface on the floor and walls. They are becoming increasingly dangerous to traverse. He had come here alone. The thought of accidentally being trapped in this tight cave sends a wave of panic through him. Ramu wonders how far down he has to go before coming upon the corpse of a mummified monk. Being alone this time, he is afraid the sight might be too much. Though not frightened easily, now he is shaking and feeling anxious. Soon the tunnel narrows. The cave begins to squeeze him so tightly that he feels his hips being pressed together. He lets out his breath and squeezes through. This is too much, he thinks to himself. I am alone, and getting stuck in a cave that no one has entered in over 100 years is more than I bargained for. He is about to turn back due to both pain and claustrophobia. Then his flashlight catches something. At first, he thinks it is a person's grave. Then he notices red letters engraved in the stone. It is a rotting monument set in the hole. He looks closely and reads the engravings. It is dedicated to a monk. The grave marker fits into a tiny crevice where the monk seems to have died. Its engraved words in ancient script state that Tokiyama fulfilled his oath and spent 50 days here to save 1,000 people in Shoji, and now dwells with the gods. Ramu does not see a body, but he decides not to wait around any longer in this tight squeeze. Claustrophobia and an eerie sense of dread are closing in on him. He believes the ancient villagers removed the body and erected this as a memorial to the monk. Ramu snaps a quick photo of the marker before making a quick retreat. On his way out, he still cannot fathom that someone, even an ascetic monk, would spend 50 days alone in this cave. A tiny little niche, barely large enough for a small man to fit in a fetal position, and he would have had no food or water, just sitting there in darkness and silence, waiting almost 2 months for death. The bats would have been his only company. But the monk, who sacrificed so much, now had a name, Tokuyama. And the townsfolk had revered him so much that they created a graveyard around his cave. This way, they could be buried near the living Buddha. They had carved a stone to remember him, and they had erected a shrine in his honor. Ramu comes to believe that many in the 19th century must have worshipped at this spot. The strange old man may have been creating his own bizarre religion, but the place itself had been revered by worshippers for 2 centuries. It is not clear how many monks tried to mummify themselves at Jukai. It is even less clear whether the self-mummification process had any long-lasting effect. Any effects must have been short-term, because in the 20th century, this forest becomes known as a place of suicide, gaining the notorious distinction as the second most popular place in the world to commit suicide. We will explore the origins of Jukai as the suicide forest in episode 3.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.